It protects them. So I made a decision. A decision that would change everything. A decision that would transform my survival from a personal story into a continental movement. I announced the formation of the African Sovereignty Defense Initiative, a coalition of African nations committed to ending Western military presence on our continent, committed to building our own security capabilities, committed to defending ourselves without depending on powers that see us as expendable. 12 nations joined immediately: Mali, Niger, Chad, Guinea, Zimbabwe, Eritrea, Tanzania, Central African Republic, Sudan, Mauritania, Congo Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea. 12 nations that said enough. Enough surveillance. Enough drone strikes. Enough civilian casualties. Enough treating African lives as less valuable than Western strategic interests. Enough assassination attempts. Enough control disguised as protection. We established collective defense protocols. If NATO attacks one of us, they attack all of us. If they attempt to assassinate one leader, they declare war on all of us. If they kill civilians in one country, they answer to all of us. We're building integrated air defense systems, sharing intelligence, training together, developing capabilities, creating security infrastructure that doesn't depend on Western approval or Western presence. And most importantly, we're documenting everything. Every drone flight, every violation of our airspace, every strike, every casualty. We're building an evidence base that will one day hold them accountable, that will one day prove what they've done, that will one day ensure justice for every African killed by Western weapons. NATO is panicking. Not because 12 African nations formed a coalition, but because those 12 nations have evidence. Evidence of drone strikes. Evidence of civilian casualties. Evidence of assassination attempts. Evidence that proves Western military presence in Africa is about control, not protection. They're panicking because we're not asking for permission anymore. We're not seeking their approval. We're not depending on their cooperation. Making our own decisions. Defending our own sovereignty. They're panicking because they tried to kill me and failed. And my survival became a symbol that African leaders can resist, can demand respect, can expose Western crimes, can build alternatives, can survive. Let me tell you what I learned from surviving that drone strike, what 17 days of knowing NATO tried to kill me taught me about power and fear and courage. I learned that they're afraid, deeply afraid, not of our militaries, not of our economies, not of our populations, but of our independence, of our refusal to obey, of our determination to be free. I learned that their control depends on our fear, on us believing they're too powerful to resist, on us accepting that challenging them means death, on us surrendering before they even have to threaten. I learned that surviving their worst attack breaks their power, because once you survive what you thought would kill you, nothing they threaten afterward matters. Once you know they've already tried to kill you and failed, sanctions and isolation and economic pressure become irrelevant. I learned that evidence is power, that documentation defeats denial, that proof forces accountability, that showing the world what they did matters more than diplomatic courtesy or international relationships. And I learned that my survival isn't just about me. It's about every African leader who will come after me. Every president who will demand respect. Every government that will choose sovereignty. Every nation that will build independence. Because if I had died that night, the message would have been clear. Defy the West and die. Demand sovereignty and be killed. Choose independence and be assassinated. But I survived. And the message is different now. The message is, they will try to kill you, but you can survive. They will attack you, but you can resist. They will threaten you, but you can expose them. They will try to silence you, but you can speak louder. That's what my survival means. That's what this moment represents. That's what shocked NATO more than anything else. Not that they missed, but that I'm still here. Still speaking. Still leading. Still defying. Still building. Still free. To every African leader watching this, they will come for you too. Maybe not with drones, maybe not with missiles, but they will come with sanctions, with coups, with pressure, with threats, with whatever tools they have to maintain control. And when they come, remember this. I survived. They tried to kill me and failed. They tried to silence me and I spoke louder. They tried to break me and I built stronger. You can survive too. You can resist too. You can build too. You can be free too. But you have to be willing to risk everything. You have to be prepared for their worst. You have to document everything. You have to expose them publicly. You have to build alternatives. You have to unite with others. You have to refuse to surrender. And most importantly, you have to understand that once they try to kill you, you have nothing left to lose. Once they show you they're willing to murder you, their other threats become meaningless. Once they reveal they see you as expendable, you're free to fight without fear. To the people of Africa, 17 days ago, NATO tried to kill your president. They failed. And what happened next is bigger than one assassination attempt, bigger than one failed drone strike, bigger than one leader's survival. What happened next is a movement of African nations saying enough, enough control, enough exploitation, enough treating our lives as expendable, enough killing our leaders who demand respect. But let me tell you exactly what this movement looks like, because it's not abstract, it's not theoretical, it's concrete, it's real, it's happening right now across this continent. 3 days after I exposed the assassination attempt, I received a call from President Goïta of Mali. He didn't go through diplomatic channels. He called my personal line at 2 a.m. His first words were, "Brother, they tried to kill you. They'll try to kill me next. We need to talk." We talked for 3 hours about sovereignty, about threats, about survival, about what it means to lead African nations that refuse to obey Western demands, about the price of independence and whether that price is worth paying. He told me something I'll never forget. He said, "When I heard they tried to drone strike you, my first reaction wasn't shock. It was recognition. Because I've been waiting for them to try it with me. I've been expecting it. Every time I travel, every time I leave the capital, I wonder if today is the day they decide I'm too much trouble to tolerate. He said, but hearing that you survived, hearing that you exposed them, hearing that you're still fighting, that changed something for me. Because I realized I don't have to wait for them to try. I don't have to live in fear of when they'll decide I'm expendable. I can act first. I can build defenses. I can create alternatives. I can unite with others who face the same threats. That conversation became the foundation of the African Sovereignty Defense Initiative, not a formal treaty drafted by diplomats, not a carefully negotiated agreement reviewed by lawyers, but a commitment between leaders who understand that our survival depends on unity, that our sovereignty requires collective defense, that our freedom demands we stand together. Within a week, 12 nations had joined. Not because we promised them economic benefits, not because we offered military aid, not because we provided security guarantees, but because every leader who joined understood one simple truth. If NATO will try to kill me for demanding respect, they'll try to kill anyone who demands respect. If they'll drone strike a president in Burkina Faso, they'll drone strike a president anywhere in Africa. If they consider one African leader expendable, they consider all of us expendable. President Tiani of Niger was the second to join. He called me and said, they've been pressuring us for months, demanding we allow more French troops, insisting we need their protection, threatening consequences if we refuse. But your survival proved something. It proved we don't need their protection. We need protection from them. He told me about a conversation he had with a French general 3 months before the assassination attempt on me. The general had said, Mr. President, you need to understand something. Niger cannot survive without French military presence. The terrorists will overrun you. Your government will collapse. Your people will suffer. You need us. President Tiani said he had believed it. He had accepted it as fact. He had structured his entire security policy around the assumption that Niger needed France more than France needed Niger. But then they tried to kill me. And everything changed. He said, when they tried to assassinate you, I realized something. If they're willing to kill a president who builds alternatives to their presence, then their presence isn't about protecting us. It's about controlling us. They don't want us to be secure. They want us to be dependent. They don't want us to be safe. They want us to need them. He said, so I told that French general to leave. I told him Niger doesn't need protection from terrorists. Niger needs protection from people who think African presidents can be killed for demanding sovereignty. And then I called you. President Déby of Chad joined next. His reasoning was different but equally powerful. He said, my father was killed. Everyone knows it. Everyone suspects who was behind it. But nobody could prove it. Nobody had evidence. Nobody could hold anyone accountable. He died, and the world moved on, and nothing changed. He said, but you have evidence. You have radar data. You have missile fragments. You have documentation. You can prove what they did, and that changes everything. Because now African leaders who are killed don't just disappear into history. Now there's proof. Now there's accountability. Now there's a record that will outlast all of us. He said, I'm joining this initiative not just to protect myself, but to ensure that if they kill me, the world will know. If they assassinate me, there will be evidence. If they try to make me disappear, there will be documentation. My death won't be mysterious. It won't be unexplained. It won't be forgotten. That's what we're building. Not just military defense. Not just security cooperation. A continental commitment to recording every violation, every attack, every crime committed against African leaders and African people. We established the African Evidence Archive. Sounds bureaucratic, sounds technical, but it's revolutionary. Every member nation contributes data, radar tracking of unauthorized flights, documentation of drone strikes, records of civilian casualties, evidence of assassinations, proof of violations, all of it stored in multiple locations, all of it backed up across the continent, all of it protected by the strongest cybersecurity we can build, all of it ready to be released if any of us are killed, all of it ensuring that our deaths won't be swept under diplomatic rugs or explained away as accidents or forgotten in the noise of international relations. President Mnangagwa of Zimbabwe joined and brought something unexpected. Experience. He survived an assassination attempt in 2018. A bomb at a political rally. He knows what it's like to be targeted. He knows what it's like to wonder who tried to kill you and whether they'll try again. He told me, when you survive an assassination attempt, you have two choices. You can become paranoid, isolated, afraid, or you can become fearless, bold, unstoppable, because you've already faced death. You've already survived your worst nightmare, and nothing they threaten afterward is worse than what you've already survived. We met in Harare 3 weeks after the drone strike. Not a formal state visit, not an official summit. Just two men who had survived what was meant to kill them, sitting in a private room, sharing experiences that most people can't imagine. He showed me the scar on his leg, still visible, still a reminder. He said, "This is from the blast, shrapnel. The doctors said I was lucky. 6 inches higher and it would have severed my femoral artery. I would have bled out before reaching the hospital." He said, "But I don't feel lucky. Lucky implies chance, random fortune, being in the right place at the right time. But I wasn't in the right place. I was exactly where they wanted me. At that rally, on that stage, in the kill zone they'd carefully prepared." He continued, "What saved me wasn't luck, it was timing. I had bent down to pick up something just as the bomb detonated. That split-second movement, that tiny change in position, that's what kept me alive. Not luck, physics, geometry, the mathematics of survival." I understood exactly what he meant. Because my survival wasn't luck either. It was the Chinese radar system that detected the drone. It was the security chief who trusted the alert. It was my decision to divert immediately. It was preparation meeting opportunity. It was capability meeting crisis. He said, "After the bombing, I spent weeks trying to understand who did it. The investigation went nowhere. No arrests, no evidence, no accountability. Just suspicions and theories and political accusations that led nowhere concrete." He said, "But I knew. Deep down, I knew. Because you don't survive in African politics for decades without understanding how power works. You don't lead a nation through sanctions and pressure and isolation without recognizing the patterns, You don't challenge Western interests without learning what happens to leaders who go too far. He leaned forward, his voice dropping to almost a whisper. My father fought in the Liberation War. He told me stories about how the Rhodesian regime targeted independence leaders, how they used bombs, poison, assassinations, how they made it look like accidents or internal conflicts, how they eliminated threats while maintaining plausible deniability. He said, the methods have changed, the technology is more sophisticated, the weapons are more precise, but the strategy is the same. Eliminate leaders who won't cooperate. Make it look like something else, deny involvement, move on. He said, when I heard about your drone strike, when I saw the evidence you presented, I felt something I hadn't felt since my own bombing. Validation, not satisfaction, not vindication, but validation. Confirmation that what I suspected was true. Proof that what happened to me wasn't an isolated incident but part of a pattern. I asked him, why didn't you expose it? Why didn't you present evidence like I did? He smiled sadly. Because I didn't have evidence like you do. I had suspicions, theories, circumstantial connections, but not radar data, not missile fragments with serial numbers, not electronic signatures proving targeting, not documentation that could withstand international scrutiny. He said, you have something I didn't have. Chinese technology that detected the threat, systems that documented the attack, capabilities that provided proof. That's why your exposure worked. That's why the world is listening. That's why NATO is panicking. Not because you accused them, but because you proved it. He told me about the aftermath of his bombing, the paranoia that followed, the security measures that became suffocating, the constant awareness that someone had tried to kill him and might try again. I stopped attending public rallies for months. He said, every crowd became a threat, every gathering became a potential kill zone, every moment in public became a calculation of risk versus necessity. He said, my security team wanted me to wear body armor everywhere, to travel in armored convoys, to limit public appearances, to live like a man under siege, and for a while, I did. Because I was afraid, because I had survived once and didn't want to test fate twice. He said, but then I realized something. If I lived in fear, they had won, not completely. They hadn't killed me, but they had changed me. They had made me smaller. They had reduced my leadership. They had limited my impact. And in some ways, that's almost as effective as killing me. He said, so I made a choice, the choice I told you about, to become fearless instead of paranoid, to be bold instead of isolated, to be unstoppable instead of afraid. He said, I started attending rallies again. Not recklessly, not without security, but publicly, visibly, defiantly, showing that I was still here, still leading, still fighting, still free. He said, and something interesting happened. The more visible I became, the more defiant I appeared, the less threatened I felt. Not because the danger decreased, but because I stopped letting the danger control me, I stopped giving them the power to make me afraid. I understood this deeply. Because after the drone strike, I faced the same choice. Hide or lead. retreat or advance. Let fear control me or control fear. I chose to be more visible, not less. I traveled more frequently, not less. I attended more public events, not fewer. Not because I'm suicidal, not because I'm reckless, but because leadership requires presence, because sovereignty demands visibility, because freedom means refusing to let threats dictate your actions. President Mnangagwa said, "But there's something else I learned, something more important than overcoming fear. I learned that surviving an assassination attempt gives you a kind of authority, a credibility that can't be manufactured or faked." He said, "When you tell other leaders that Western powers will try to kill them if they resist, they can dismiss it as paranoia, as exaggeration, as political rhetoric. But when you show them the scar from the bomb that tried to kill you, when you display the evidence of the drone that tried to kill you, it's not rhetoric anymore. It's reality. It's documented. It's undeniable." He said, "That's why I joined your initiative immediately. Not just for protection, not just for solidarity, but because together, we have something powerful. We have proof. We have experience. We have credibility. We have the authority that comes from surviving what was meant to kill us." He told me about a conversation he had with a younger African president, a leader who had been hesitant about challenging Western demands, who had been cautious about building alternative partnerships, who had been afraid of the consequences of independence. President Mnangagwa showed him the scar, told him about the bombing, explained the investigation that went nowhere, described the years of wondering who tried to kill him and whether they'd try again. And then he said to that young president, "This is what happens when you challenge them. Not always, not immediately, but eventually, when you become too independent, when you demand too much respect, when you build too many alternatives, they come for you. With bombs or drones or coups or sanctions, they come for you." He said the young president went pale, asked if he was serious, asked if this really happened, asked if Western powers really assassinate African leaders. President Mnangagwa lifted his pant leg, showed the scar again, said, "This is my answer. This is my proof. This is what happens when you forget that our sovereignty threatens their control." That young president joined our initiative 2 weeks later. President Mnangagwa said, "That's the power of survival. Not just that we lived, but that we can show others what we survived. We can prove that the threats are real. We can demonstrate that the danger is genuine. We can validate what everyone suspects but nobody wants to believe." He said, "Most African leaders live with a quiet fear, a background anxiety that if they go too far, if they demand too much, if they resist too strongly, something will happen. They'll be cooped, they'll be sanctioned, they'll be isolated, or worse." He said, "But it's abstract, it's theoretical, it's something that happens to other people in other countries at other times. It's not immediate, it's not personal. It's not real enough to overcome the temptation to cooperate, to comply, to accept Western terms." He said, "But when they see us, when they hear our stories, when they examine our evidence, it becomes real, it becomes immediate, it becomes personal, and that changes their calculation. Because suddenly the threat isn't theoretical, it's documented, it's proven, it's undeniable." I asked him, Do you ever regret it? Do you ever wish you had been more cautious, more compliant, more willing to accept their terms? He looked at me like I had asked the most absurd question imaginable. Regret surviving, regret standing, regret demanding respect. Never, not for a single moment. He said, I regret that someone tried to kill me. I regret that African leaders face this choice. I regret that sovereignty comes with such a high price, but I don't regret paying that price. Because the alternative is worse. He said, the alternative is living as a puppet, governing with permission, leading at their discretion, serving their interests while pretending to serve my people. That's not leadership. That's performance. That's theater. That's slavery with a presidential title. He said, I'd rather be a president who survived an assassination attempt than a president who never needed to be assassinated because he never threatened anyone's control. I'd rather have this scar than have the shame of knowing I sold my people's sovereignty for my personal safety. He said, and here's what they don't understand. Here's what they miscalculated. Every assassination attempt that fails makes us stronger. Every bombing that doesn't kill us makes us bolder. Every drone strike that misses makes us more determined. He said, because we've faced death and survived. We've confronted their worst and endured. We've experienced what they hoped would break us, and it made us unbreakable instead. That's not leadership. That's performance. That's theater. That's slavery with a presidential title. He said, I'd rather be a president who survived an assassination attempt than a president who never needed to be assassinated because he never threatened anyone's control. I'd rather have this scar than have the shame of knowing I sold my people's sovereignty for my personal safety. He said, and here's what they don't understand. Here's what they miscalculated. Every assassination attempt that fails makes us stronger. Every bombing that doesn't kill us makes us bolder. Every drone strike that misses makes us more determined. He said, because we've faced death and survived. We've confronted their worst and endured. We've experienced what they hoped would break us, and it made us unbreakable instead. He stood up, walked to the window, looked out over Harare. You know what I see when I look at this city? I see a nation that survived sanctions, that endured isolation, that persisted through pressure, that refused to break even when breaking seemed inevitable. He turned back to me. And you know what that taught me? That survival is a skill, that endurance is a strategy, that persistence is power. That refusing to surrender, even when surrender seems rational, is the ultimate form of resistance. He said, they tried to kill me in 2018. I'm still here, still leading, still resisting, still building. And every day I survive is a day they failed. Every decision I make independently is a decision they couldn't control. Every partnership I build outside their system is a partnership they couldn't prevent. He said, that's what I brought to your initiative. Not just my experience surviving an assassination attempt, but my experience turning survival into power. My knowledge of how to live with the constant awareness that they might try again. My understanding of how to lead effectively while knowing that leadership makes you a target. He said, and most importantly, I brought proof. Proof that this isn't new. Proof that you're not the first. Proof that there's a pattern. Proof that what happened to you is part of a systematic effort to eliminate African leaders who demand too much sovereignty. He said, together, we're not just two presidents who survived assassination attempts, we're documentation, we're evidence, we're proof of a pattern, and patterns can be exposed. Patterns can be documented. Patterns can be stopped. He shook my hand. They tried to kill both of us. They failed both times. And now we're united. Now we're building. Now we're creating something they can't destroy by killing one or two leaders. We're a continental awakening. He said, I chose fearless, bold, unstoppable, and I see you've chosen the same. Now let's be fearless together, because 12 fearless African leaders are harder to kill than one. And a continent of fearless nations is impossible to control. That conversation changed how I understood my own survival. It wasn't just about me. It wasn't just about Burkina Faso. It was about establishing a pattern of resistance. About proving that African leaders can survive assassination attempts. About demonstrating that sovereignty is achievable even when powerful forces want you dead. President Mnangagwa taught me that survival is the first step, but turning survival into power is the second step. Using survival to inspire others is the third step. Building a movement of survivors who refuse to be controlled is the final step. We're on that final step now. Building something they can't stop, creating something they can't destroy, establishing something that will outlast all of us. Because we've already faced death. We've already survived our worst nightmare. And nothing they threaten afterward is worse than what we've already survived. He said, I chose fearless, and I see you've chosen the same. Now let's be fearless together, because 12 fearless African leaders are harder to kill than one. And a continent of fearless nations is impossible to control. We're building something they can't stop, a network of sovereign nations, a coalition of independent governments, a continent that defends itself, an Africa that doesn't ask permission, that doesn't fear threats, that doesn't surrender to pressure.